Welcome to International Dispute Negotiation, your guide to resolving disputes everywhere.
This is Mike McElrath, and this podcast is about different ways of accepting and managing the risks of dispute resolution, presenting them through the eyes of experts from different countries and backgrounds.
Just the next step in the analysis is the extreme localism of the organization of the administration of justice in the United States. The fundamental foundation there is not the state, such as New York or California, it is the county. The academic world now classifies the system. There's the U.S. and then there's everybody else.
In the U.S. versus the rest of the world, there are many things, almost idiosyncrasies, that can be said to set the U.S. civil justice system apart. For example, juries deciding civil cases, the availability of substantial punitive and other forms of damages, lawyers who are allowed to invest in their clients' cases through contingency fees. In this episode of IDN, Professor Jeffrey Hazard discusses these distinctive aspects of U.S. civil justice, as well as the social and regulatory forces that drive them. Professor Hazard is a professor emeritus at Yale Law School and a distinguished professor of law at the Hastings College of Law in San Francisco. He is a leading expert on U.S. and international civil procedure and legal ethics. To give just one example, his bio in Wikipedia refers to his treatise, Civil Procedure, as a, quote, mainstay of American legal education. We started by discussing the results of a survey by the international law firm Lovells, in which European corporate counsel were asked to identify the legal systems they feared and most wished to avoid. The largest percentage, over 30% of those responding, named the United States. Tied for second place were Russia and China, each receiving half as many votes as the U.S. I asked Professor Hazard whether, in his view, civil justice in the United States really is twice as dangerous as Russia or China.
It's dangerous in a different way. It has more stable law, I think, less vulnerability to government intervention in commercial disputes, certainly. But the procedure in American legal system is expensive and prolonged, and that by comparison with any other legal system, and therefore frustrating and aggravating, I think you'd get about the same margin of disapproval of on the part of business executives in the United States.
But they would also say that they don't like the U.S.
Definitely do not. Now, there are important constituencies in the United States that do like it. It's famous that plaintiff's lawyers like it. But many people who think of themselves as representatives of social interests, people concerned about employment discrimination, people concerned about protection of the environment, people interested in civil rights, bringing the government itself to account. For example, the litigation now going on about Guantanamo and federal surveillance. So there are important, generally speaking, reformist, sometimes you could call them leftist, left-center people who want more accountability, more visibility of the workings of private organizations and public organizations, think that the American system is to be preferred. They think, I believe, that ultimately you could get to a jury, so they think, and that in the meantime you could get substantial discovery, depositions, bringing people to the table to confess or talk under oath, and discovery of the documents, figuring out, identifying what are the real documents involved. Therefore, they are aligned generally wanting to maintain something like the present system. So it's a fundamental political, cultural, ultimately perhaps even moral divide between, generally speaking, the business establishment, business people, on the one hand, and folks who think they're talking for the ordinary citizen, on the other hand.
It's interesting that you focus on things that are not, that I would say do not fall within the typical divide between the common law and the civil law systems, but rather that an argument could be made, and I think has been made, that, you know, in today's modern world, it's not so much the civil law versus common law systems, but the rest of the world versus the United States as a legal system.
Oh, I think that's right. In fact, the topic of an international comparative law conference I recently attended was American exceptionalism, and that is the way the academic world now classifies the system. There's the U.S., and then there's everybody else.
Everybody else, right.
And as I said in that connection, just the next step in the analysis is to realize that in the American legal system, apart from the political cultural divide I've already mentioned, is the extreme localism of the organization of the administration of justice in the United States. The fundamental foundation there is not the state, such as New York or California. It is the county. And a county in Illinois, for example, Madison County, Illinois, which is in the middle of the state, just opposite St. Louis, is regarded as Death Valley by business corporations. And the doing of justice in Illinois, in that sense, is not Illinois as such, but is Madison County as such. That's where the jurors will come from if there's a jury trial, and that's where the judges have been born and raised. So it's a very distinctly local culture, and you get some counties that are whose general cultural and political sentiment is very strongly populist. Madison County is such one. And that's where plaintiffs will, if they have any venue choices available to them, that's where they'll target their litigation. And there are a number of other counties in the United States of a similar sort. So if you add that, as it were, governmental structure problem to the cultural division, you get a combination of political and cultural forces that make American civil justice truly exceptional.
And you've hit on something here that I think is just looks, frankly, bizarre, and that is the jury trial in civil cases. I mean, it just, to someone who comes from a system, which is, I think, virtually every system around the world that does not have this concept of private citizens coming in to hear citizens coming in to hear a dispute between private parties, and the variation that goes on from county to county, state to state within the United States, it can make it very unpredictable to a party who's entered into a contract to think that their rights may or may not be determined by people that aren't even professional judges.
Well, that's right, and we've had over the last 50 years in the states a very strong reformist approach to assure that the selection of jurors is demographically universal, whereas if you went back 50 or 70 years ago, the jurors were selected from among people that were regarded as good citizens, which would typically mean, in those days, white, middle class, and upper middle class, predominantly male people, who would have whatever we might think of as the common viewpoint widely shared among that social stratum. Now, your typical jury will be more often composed of people whose average educational level is high school, maybe a year of college after that.
So it's even worse than I just made it sound.
Oh, yeah. In other words, if you now add the further fact of the basis of selection of the jury, that it makes it still more, as it were, populist local than I indicated before. Now, the fact of the matter is most cases, civil cases, don't go to jury trial. But it's the threat of jury trial and the prospect that plaintiffs and plaintiffs' lawyers can say, you know, you got to settle this case on better terms than you've been offering, or we'll take it to trial. And trial means trial in front of one of those, a jury so constituted.
Speaking from a party, a corporate party, I think that it would be fair to say we're more comfortable with arbitration in some cases because it can be more predictable.
Yes, no question about it.
With the alternative of not knowing who you might get as an adjudicator.
Well, that's right, and I happen to think, oddly enough, the same logic applies, helps explain why so many American cases that are eligible to go to a jury don't go to a jury, and that's because, as between the counsel for the plaintiff and counsel for the defendant, their range of difference in estimating the settlement value of a case is narrower than the range possibly obtainable among a jury, so that they're kind of in the middle of the normal curve, so to speak, and they can reach understanding about a proper range of settlement and get to settlement because they both regard the outlier at one end of the extreme and the other extreme with considerable anxiety and uncertainty.
Well, speaking of the uncertainty, one of the other things that parties may be concerned about is something else, and to speak of another idiosyncrasy about the U.S. system, and that's the availability of punitive damages, which for listeners who don't know what that is, or punitive or exemplary damages, it may be damages that are not proportional to the actual injury that was suffered, but are intended to discourage further behavior and can go into many millions of dollars.
Well, that too, and then you also have the so-called pain and suffering damages, that is, intangible psychological and personal discomfiture damages that are another big chunk of potential recovery under American law. And I think if you look at both of those in context, comparison with other systems, particularly those of Europe, punitive damages are justified in the United States on the ground that this is a private party law enforcement mechanism to compensate for what is regarded as inadequate government regulation and intervention, so that punitive damages, for example, in sale of insurance, fraudulent or wrongfully written automobile insurance or life insurance, the person favoring the idea of punitive damages would say, well, you know, that's a way of getting at those guys because the insurance commissioners in our state just won't do anything about it. So you're talking about it as a response, so to speak, to regulatory failure. And the pain and suffering, you could say, is a response to the absence of a social safety net. In a typical European situation, if somebody gets hurt in somehow or other, typically, they'll have two forms of insurance available. One will be medical insurance, so you don't have to worry about doctors and hospital bills. And the other will be some kind of compensation during a period when you're unemployable. Now, we don't have either system as a general proposition in the United States, so that the basis, the civil law remedy of damages is regarded as a kind of offset or compensation adjustment for that. And at the rhetorical level, that makes some sense. At the statistical level, it makes no sense at all because, of course, it's only in a small fraction of the cases where people are seriously hurt that compensation through the civil liability system will actually be realized.
So you're saying that the American judicial system, the legal system, is set up the way it is, not so much in terms of the justice that's being delivered, but to make up for certain deficiencies in the social structure that exists. Or to put it differently, in Europe, throughout Europe, there are these social safety nets, the social network. People are compensated regardless of whether they're at work or somewhere else. They will have access to medical care. They will have access to some sort of support structure if they're injured. And as a result, let's say the legal system is not quite as generous as it is in the U.S.
Exactly. It doesn't have to perform that function. And all of that derives from the major social intervention systems, the safety nets, beginning what, in 1870 in Germany, but they've now become general in Europe, and they are fragmentary in the United States.
It's interesting looking at the social, looking at the legal system as the product of social forces.
Absolutely. And then there's the other side of it, which should be taken into account, in my opinion. The American system has many of the debatable characteristics you've described. It also makes available to people who feel the system is being unresponsive a residual tribunal where they can complain. And they can complain against government, they can complain against private businesses. And in my opinion, that's a very important political force in the United States, to be able to complain about bad design of automobiles, to complain about bad design of some of the pharmaceuticals. They will say, and there's validity to it, we wouldn't need this if the regulatory system were getting on the back of the automobile companies as they used to. The automobiles are now pretty safe. But this wouldn't be happening if the Federal Drug Administration was really on top of the problem about pharmaceuticals, etc. So in a sense, the access to justice in the American scene is a compensation for what we may call a regulatory failure.
Let's talk about this other, I think, fairly described as an idiosyncrasy of the U.S. system, which is the contingency fee.
Yeah. Which
is basically a lawyer's stake in a litigation, in a claim, in return for the fees.
The typical arrangement will be that of the gross amount of recovery, compensatory damages, pain and suffering damages, maybe punitive damages, the lawyer gets one-third, sometimes 40%, depends on the particular contract, sometimes less, which is a substantial sum. And they think, oh, they bring these suits all the time.
30 to 40% of the amount that gets recovered.
The gross amount. So if you get a verdict of $300,000, the lawyer's fee will be $100,000. Now, the lawyer will have had to front the expenses, and if the case is lost, the lawyer bears that loss. If the case is won, there may be addition. The lawyer will also get paid the amount of expenses that he paid in advance.
So the lawyer actually invests in litigation.
Yeah, absolutely. Not only his time, he invests in paying for the depositions, for the experts, for the exhibits, for the trial setup, and so on. Now, you've given that, you can figure out the economics of it. A plaintiff's lawyer is only going to bring suit against some defendant that's got lots of money or lots of insurance, because you have no point in trying to sue somebody who couldn't pay if you got a judgment. And that, in turn, also means that because those people have money, they're going to resist with their own lawyers and their own discovery apparatus, meaning that the plaintiff's lawyer has to face the fact that this is going to be an expensive trial, which means, in turn, that he or she is not going to take cases unless they're pretty good evidence that they could prove it if they had to prove liability if they went to trial, and there's going to be big bucks involved. Well, then the public mind comes the idea, well, plaintiff's lawyers bring these cases. They're bringing big cases and getting them, lots of money. And, of course, business people think, yeah, that's what they're doing. Well, they are doing it, but in a very small percentage of cases. If you talk to plaintiff's lawyers, you'll find that they will take maybe one of five, one of eight cases that are referred to them by some other lawyer. Said, we got somebody badly hurt. What do you think? The response from the experienced plaintiff's lawyer will be four out of five times, or maybe more often, I can't help you because the chances of liability are just, and damages are too remote. I can't afford to invest what it's going to take to bring that case.
So they're only going to bring the stronger cases.
Absolutely.
But when they do, they've got a real stake
they've
in
got
seeing
a real,
that.
Oh, absolutely. They're making an investment in it. And they're aiming at cases where the recovery could be I think now you're talking about 300,000, 500,000, a million. You've got to get up there before it's worth it for a skillful plaintiff's lawyer to invest in what it takes to win a case.
Now, I'm not going to talk about discovery, which is something that can take up a lot of time and money in a case. But there is one other, that's, I don't want to call it an idiosyncrasy, but the importance that the common law system places on witness evidence over document evidence. And a line or phrase that I use fairly often is that the common law system or common law approach is you need a witness to authenticate a document often to get it in. Not always, but often you will want to have the witness with a preference for witness testimony. The civil law systems would often say, by contrast, what do you need a witness for if you got a document?
I think you could say that the authentication of a document is an interesting illustration of the more general point that particularly the American common law has attached great significance to witness testimony, whereas other systems, particularly the civil law systems, attach great importance, often decisive importance, to documents. Again, if you understand America as a kind of populist culture, the idea that somebody will come here and swear on a Bible what he thinks he saw or she thinks she saw, that's regarded as God's honest truth.
But even with all we've learned in the last 20, 50 years about the unreliability of witness testimony and the mind and the way the mind works and memory and how plastic it is, it still there's a preference for witnesses.
Well, you can say that we have learned that. Maybe you and I have as our highfalutin college education. But I put it to you that the average high school graduate wouldn't think that.
The average jury member.
That's what we're talking about.
They're going to believe the person testifying, even if what they say is the exact opposite of what's in the document.
The witness will also say, I didn't understand that this was one of those fancy corporate documents they push in front of you in the bank, and I have no idea what it meant.
So to conclude here, let's look. We've got unreliable adjudicators, or let's say adjudicators who are not professional and can be at times unpredictable. The risk of large damages, punitive damages, and pain of suffering type damages, contingency fees that can drive lawyers to take stakes in their claims and to see claims fight more aggressively maybe than somebody else might have, and this preference for witness testimony over documents. Is there anything that would suggest that you, if you had a choice between resolving disputes, let's say in Milan or Paris, or taking them to New York, why would anybody choose New York, given that level of unpredictability?
Well, that's a sharp contrast, but imagine taking it to Madison County, Illinois.
Okay, let's take it to Madison County, Illinois.
That would be Death Valley from the point of view of the typical corporate defendant, and you'd want to settle early, or try to wear down the other side and then settle.
But let's take these a fair contrast or a fair choice. You know, you have a New York dispute resolution in New York or dispute resolution in Paris. Given that we've just walked through, is there any reason that a party might actually want to prefer New York over Paris, or would the sane and rational party say, "I'm going to take Paris every single time, but I'm given that choice"?
If your dispute is covered by an arbitration agreement, I don't think it makes much difference. If it's not, then you have the risks of exposure to the American civil justice system.
Which one would you choose?
Well, I think I would go for arbitration and pick the more convenient venue.
The one that's closer to you?
Well, Paris is a very nice place to be.
Okay. Thanks very much.
You're quite welcome.
You've been listening to International Dispute Negotiation. This podcast is presented by the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. CPR is a membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes excellence and innovation in public and private dispute resolution, providing an international resource for the avoidance, management, and resolution of business disputes. For further information about CPR, or to download archived versions of this podcast, go to www.cpradr.org. Questions about this podcast or the issues discussed can be addressed to idn@cpradr.org. The music of Note Noir is used with permission.